So as Pastor John was saying, this summer we are doing a series on the Ten Commandments, where each week we will take one or two commandments and explore the ethics behind them and how they might apply to our lives today, going beyond a strict following of the commandment as it is written. This week, we are examining the commandment about idols. In Exodus 20, verses 3 to 6, it says, "You shall not make for yourself an idol, whether in the form of anything that is in heaven above, or that is on earth beneath, or that is in the waters under the earth. You shall not bow down to them or worship them." And this is one of my favorite commandments because it's just so darn ironic. You see, while Moses was busy learning these holy laws from an all-powerful God who just sent 9 terrifying plagues to the Egyptians for not listening to that God, the Israelites, who weren't invited onto the mountain, were getting kind of antsy waiting for Moses. And they were ready to make things happen. So with the help of Aaron in Exodus 32, they make this beautiful golden calf, and they start worshiping it. It's always struck me how odd, how quickly the Israelites go from seeing those plagues into worshiping a golden calf. It's just because Moses wasn't there for a little bit. Well, as you might expect, Moses and God were kind of peeved when they learned about this. So when Moses comes down from the mountain, he stomps over in good Hollywood fashion. I love this. And he takes the calf that they made, burned it with fire, ground it into a powder, scattered it on the waters, and made the Israelites drink it. I mean, that's just so hardcore. Like, that's the kind of stuff that I'll never be able to do, but I wish I could. I can kind of see the story as a comedy, where the punchline is the Israelites drinking the creation with a look of just like, oh, this is gross. But let's try to be as generous as possible and say that maybe it wasn't so ridiculous for the Israelites to make the calf. I mean, there have been times in my life where I didn't know what to expect, and I was filled with anxiety, or I was let down by how things happened, or how I believed they were going to happen. When we put the Israelites in that mindset, it doesn't seem as silly to me. I'm going to leave that there for now, let you guys chew on that. And we're going to go to the passage today in Luke, the passage where Jesus says for us to hate. Now, this passage from Luke is a doozy. It's one of those that you're always like, thanks be to God. Jesus says, "Whoever comes to me and does not hate father and mother, wife and child, brother and sister, yes, life itself, cannot be my disciple." In my New Testament class, I'm in divinity school, if everyone, you know, for the visitors. In my New Testament class, with Professor A.J. Levine, who we did a Lenten Bible study on, we were asked to write a research paper about a passage in Scripture. I had been struggling with what passage to choose. There's like one or two of them, and there's a lot to choose, and so I didn't know which one to go for. Luckily, Professor A.J. Levine was ready for it and graciously suggested me the parable of the dishonest manager. I'd never heard of it, and so, of course, I said yes. So that was the first and last time I ever take advice from a professor for a research paper. The passage is awful. In the parable Jesus tells in Luke 16, there was a manager who was about to be fired, and so does a selfish, if not illegal, action and reduces a considerable amount of debt owed to his former boss, so that when he got fired, the people he reduced the debts of would take care of him. It ends with this verse in Luke 16:9. "I tell you, make friends for yourself by means of dishonest wealth, so that when it is gone, they may welcome you into their eternal homes." I mean, what am I going to do with that? Make friends with dishonest wealth? Like, there are so many things going on here. But I'm a good student. I try to be. And I buckled down, and I was determined to do a good job because Professor A.J. Levine is very hard. Every week, I would send a new outline or an explanation to Professor Levine, and without fail, every week, I got completely shut down, with more words in red ink than I had actually written. No matter what I came up with, there was always a major hole in my argument. She almost seemed to find joy in showing me just how hard explaining Bible passages could be. Well, I've been through this. I can do it a second time, right? So this week, for this passage, I did my research, and I had developed my argument for what I was going to say in this sermon. I started with the idea of hate. It says to hate your mother, father, wife, child, brother, sister. And so, what does hate really mean? Luckily, I stumbled upon a German philosopher from the early 20th century named Max Scheler. He argues that love and hate create value for the things and ideas that we come in contact in our life. Now, you see, that'll preach. Because now, what Jesus is actually saying is that we shouldn't be providing our own value to things. When we do that, we are making idols. Sure, we can still care for our parents, but it must be grounded in God first because the value comes from God. Done. We are done. Let's celebrate communion. I can sit down, right? No, I guess I can't. But we're called to hate in this passage, which is a way of portraying value. So that's not allowing the value to come from God because we are the ones doing the hating. So that doesn't work. I'll try again, Professor Levine. How about some research I found where John Wesley commented on this passage? John Wesley was the founder of Methodism. This is United Methodist Church, connecting dots. As a good Methodist, I completely agree with everything John Wesley has ever written, ever. In his New Testament commentary, he says about this passage, "If any man come to me and hate not his father, comparatively to Christ, so as to actually renounce his field, oxen, wife, all things, and act as if he hated him, when in competition with Jesus." All right. So the deal with this passage is really talking about how much love we should have for Jesus, that when we compare it to how things, other things, it looks like hate. But it's not really hate. Oh. But I don't think Jesus says in comparison to your love for me. I mean, sure, I don't think John Wesley is wrong, ever, but I see Dr. Levine's favorite line. Where does it say that in the text? But I have another one. You see, there are a few things in this world that have instrumental good, things that are good in and of themselves. Most things are just good in relation to that, which is actually good. Like money is good in relation to buying education or vanilla lattes, which are good in relation for better jobs and caffeine highs. And those are just good in relation because those are wonderful things. And then you get to the point of God in is the one true good. Okay. It's a complicated text. And this is where I found myself Wednesday. All my ideas didn't seem to work. I was trying to get the reins of Jesus' message for us today so that I could come here and tell you all what was going on. Well, in my pseudo-despair, I went to the Divinity School library to discuss my sermon with my friends. And I love my friends, and they are so wonderful. One of the things I love about my friends is how you can always count on them to not help you at all and to actually make things more complicated. Instead of bringing clarity to the challenge of this passage, we got into a heated debate about biblical exegesis, which is a critical explanation of the text. One person, let's call him Hunter Rhodes because that's his name, said that he didn't think Jesus is speaking in hyperbole, that it could actually mean a call to hate. Which brought up the question of when is a passage metaphorical or literal? I mean, who decides that? If something in the Bible makes us uncomfortable, like this passage did for me, what is that evidence of? I think the problem is that we like answers. But not only that, we like answers that we agree with. All week I have been discomforted by this passage as I've tried my hardest to create an argument that aligns with what I already believe. I mean, a month ago, my entire sermon was on how you should honor your mother and father. And now I have the message to hate them. I mean, I don't believe I'm supposed to hate people, much less the people who made room in their lives for me and for my well-being. I had to face the fact this week that may be part of what an idol is, a way to have control. In my desire to make sense of this passage, I relied on previous experiences and beliefs. I turned to the arguments that I can make to provide the answers that give me that control. I can make the argument that hating is just hyperbole. I can build up the argument that it is only in comparison for my love to Jesus does it only look like hate. And these things could be true. I think that they are true. But when do those arguments that I make for myself become my own golden calf? After reflecting about the conversation with my divinity school friends, I realized something. We had spent the whole time, like 3 hours, talking about the literal and metaphorical idea of hate, while at the same time, nobody was against the idea that Jesus is expecting commitment in this passage. There was a call to commit one's entire life, all of our possessions, to living the way that God calls us to live. I mean, there's even two parables about it. A builder who must plan ahead to make the decision, and also a king that notices he can't face an army before it happens and so makes reasonable action. It was so easy for me to show my friends the golden calf that I had made that I had completely ignored what was actually going on in this passage. That was the realization that became my Hollywood comic punchline as I swallowed the dust of my golden calf. Jesus said, "Whoever does not carry the cross and follow me cannot be my disciple." I like this imagery of carrying the cross because my friend Kevin Crawford, a couple years ago when I was a teenager, asked me this question. If we are called to pick up the cross, then what are we supposed to put down? That answer is very, very complicated. But I think one of the answers for us today is that in order to carry the cross, in order to commit our lives to God, we have to set down our idols. Those idols that we have spent time and effort cultivating. The idols that allow us to have control over how we see the world and how we interact with the world. The idols that we've created because of our need to have everything figured out so we can just rely on ourselves. When people first heard these words from Jesus in first century Jewish culture, there must have been quite a shock. You see, the family was everything. They provided food, shelter, security, stability. It just made sense. You lived with your entire extended family. These words would have struck the heart of those hearing them. To hate the thing that they provided stability? But it's maybe that reversal from love to hate that needs to happen. I mean, the things that prevent us from fully embracing God's will in our lives, I mean, they need to go. They maybe even need to be hated. Hated because of their resiliency that comes from our constant need to have control, to have it all figured out. But in the end, I don't think God calls us to hate people. Instead, I think God knows how easily we make golden calves. The Israelites needed very little time to revert to an idol. The moment things go astray, I think that we cling to our idols that don't ask us to do hard things. For some people, I think families can be an idol. I think material things can be an idol. Sports, arguments, logic, exercise, anything can become our idols. To put down those idols and to pick up our cross is a commitment that is fully on us. I mean, is it up to us to believe that God can do more than our idols that we create? It is up to us to believe that God is enough. Amen.